You're listening to the Pandemic Podcast. We equip you to live the most real life possible in the face of today's crises. My name is Matt Bodker, and I'm joined with just my one good friend, Dr. Stephen Kissler in Boston there at the Harvard School of Public Health. How you doing there, buddy? How's it going?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. How are you doing?
Good. You look good in blue, by the way.
Thank
For those
you.
Of you who are just listening, you can't tell that I don't think I've ever seen you look that sharp on a podcast. So it's great to see it on you. Well, it's good to have everybody be back this week, 2 weeks in a row after being gone for a couple of weeks. And it seems like there's a lot to talk about. It's weird. I feel like there's a little bit of a, Groundhog's Day. I don't want to put that like kind of resurfacing last summer stuff. So I feel like we say the same thing over and over, like with like an onion, but we peel the onion back and there's like a different layer to it. It's a little bit nuanced, but it's the same stuff. And I think Stephen will carry us all the way through this episode. Obviously, I'll ask all the questions that's probing my mind and my heart right now. Before we get started with that, a couple few things makes no sense, by the way. So just FYI, a couple things. The first thing is please leave a review. That would be awesome. You can do that at Apple Podcasts. I think there's other places you can leave reviews. We just got a one last week. I have to read it. I gave it to Stephen and Mark and it was awesome. This is from S. Hain from Thursday. Title, finally clear science-based pandemic, and then it goes dot, dot, dot. I can't read that. But here's the actual comment. I love it. I've been following this podcast since the beginning of the podcast, so thank you, by the way. And it's fantastic. I'm always looking for the data without the bias and skewing of information with the political agenda. What I appreciate about these guys, they give a few different perspectives, yet it's solely focused on helping the average person look at this pandemic through the lens of a professional. They look at the complexities, don't try to have an answer for everything, and are humble as they navigate all the news data as it rolls in. Best part, I don't even know their politics. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
I love that. I just want to navigate this the best I can and truly want to understand the science that's coming in. Thank you guys so much for this podcast. You are all great. Thank you so much, S. Hain. Greatly appreciate that. It inspires us.
Yeah, I appreciate that
a ton.
That's
good
really,
job, Steve.
Yeah, those are some great words. Appreciate that a lot.
Yeah. So any more reviews, we love them. We can read them as we continue along on the episodes. If you want to support us in other ways, you can do that at patreon.com/pandemicpodcast. Those $5 a month can go a long ways to help us keep this going, or a one-time gift through PayPal or Venmo, all in the show notes. So let's get going with all this update and news. And I kind of want to, I don't know how I'm going to package all of this. First, I had this, Stephen, in a bunch of different kind of subheadings and different areas, but I think we can talk about this all in one big picture. So I want to frame it as this. So I read an article, where was this article? It says, okay, a new way to visualize the surge in COVID-19 cases in the US. I'll put this in the show notes for those of you who want to read along, please do so. This is a great article. There's a handful of solid articles that came out in the past 7 days. This one in particular really got me going because it reminded me of what I mentioned to you, Stephen, and Mark just over a year ago in April-ish, when things were still crazy, maybe May, and I was getting all of these people coming my way who knew that we started a podcast and all this kind of stuff, and proclaiming that, hey, this is no different. COVID is no different than the flu. And they would show these rates and they show how it's different. And look at how many people it kills in a year for the flu. And look where you're at COVID. And so my best comparison was, okay, that's like comparing my old crummy 2008 Nissan 4-cylinder and just flooring it for 10 seconds, giving it maybe 90 miles per hour in like 10 seconds, probably. And then comparing it to a Tesla at second one and then say, look, my Nissan's going 90. The Tesla's going 45 in 1 second. And clearly my Nissan is faster. So game close, right? But we know that wasn't true because at the same time, the flu has been going for years and COVID was revving up. How does this article come into play? The new way to visualize is all about this idea of acceleration. That it's one thing to see our normal stuff, right, Stephen? We see the daily cases and they're going up and we see the chart and they're going down. But that's just one measurement. I think the measurement of my niece on the Tesla was the example of what you didn't really think about is the acceleration property. And the acceleration right now, and you can speak into this, is really crazy. It's on the order of what we were dealing with last winter. So this is what's weird. Like we're living a last winter acceleration and we're living a life almost, when you go out, kind of pandemic free. How do we make sense of all this? What's a common denominator? What's different between now and back in December, where we were much more careful?
Yeah, so there's, you know, there's a couple of things that have changed. And I think you're right that thinking about the acceleration is really the right thing to do here. In a lot of ways, the reproduction number that we've been talking about is a pretty good measure of that acceleration rate. It's not exactly that. There's another thing, you know, the reproduction number we represent with the big R, which is the number of people who you're expected to infect. But that doesn't inherently have a notion of how quickly you infect those people. So if you have something with a reproduction number of 2, you might infect those 2 people in a day, or you might infect those 2 people in 10 years. And that, of course, leads to a very different kind of acceleration, right? So the big R would be that 2, but the little r is the exponential rate of increasing cases. And that's the acceleration we're interested in. And it's related to big R because, of course, the more people you infect, the faster you're going to accelerate. But it also really matters how quickly you infect those people. Mm-hmm. So where does that leave us, right? So it's pretty clear that in a lot of places, especially places that have started to see outbreaks of the Delta variant, that the acceleration is Tesla style, right? We saw that definitely when we saw the Delta variant taking off in India and now in the UK, now in the US. But I think especially when we were looking at what was happening in India, it was unbelievable that it was like the case counts just hit this, you know, vertical wall. It just went straight up very quickly, a very fast acceleration. The acceleration in the UK and the US has not been quite that fast, in part because we were able to see it coming. We saw what had happened in India and we were able to sort of prepare ourselves a little bit. But it's still been very fast. Like you said, it's been about as fast as it's been in previous waves, which is pretty wild if we take a step back because, you know, this is happening in the context of the summer, whereas this virus tends to be a seasonal virus where we expect the transmission to be strongest in the winter. It's happening certainly in the US and the UK in the context of vaccination rates. So, you know, vaccination rates are certainly not anywhere near 80, 90, 100%, but we still have people vaccinated. And so that should slow things down too. And so really, I think what this is getting at is just how infectious this Delta variant is, that in the midst of all of these things, we're still seeing the spread of the Delta. Now, on the other side, of course, I am behaving very differently than I was 6 months ago. Many people are behaving very differently than they were 6 months ago. And so helping the Delta along is that generally we're seeing more people, it just has more opportunities to spread. And so some of the increase, some of this acceleration that we're seeing is inherent to the variant. Some of it is just due to the changes in our behavior, but those things together have really helped us sort of see an increase that's sort of on par with what we've seen in the winter months. So definitely things are different than they were a few months ago, but with sort of all of these changes that are moving it in different directions, what we end up is with a scenario where the increase in cases looks very similar to the way that it did sort of in early December. Before we move on, though, I want to break that down a little bit further because it's been really interesting here in the US because we've in many ways sort of lagged behind the UK by 6 to 8 weeks or so. In a lot of instances, sort of the UK has seen a surge first and then we've seen it here in the US. And actually our overall epidemics have looked pretty similar in a lot of ways, with the exception of that lag, which for those of us here in the US is kind of a fortunate thing because we can look to them to sort of see what to expect in the near future. And so one of the things that I want to emphasize about this is if you look at the case counts in the UK, the overall surge is finally starting to come down. So they've started to see sustained decreases in the number of cases, but the size of that surge in terms of the number of cases was pretty similar to the one that they saw in December, January. But if you compare the number of deaths that they've observed, it's vastly lower. And so we've been talking a lot about delays. You know, have we waited long enough to actually see that increase in deaths? Well, at this point, yes. We would expect, even though cases in the UK are coming down, we would expect the deaths to still be increasing. But if you compare the raw number of the number of deaths per case that we see now in the UK versus the number of deaths per case that we were seeing at this equivalent point in the epidemic curve, it's vastly, vastly lower. And I would encourage everyone to take a look at the data. I was looking at the New York Times portal for this, but you can see this in a number of different locations. And it's actually really quite encouraging that what looks like a very similar scenario is in fact quite different. And I really attribute that to the vaccine, that a lot of people, especially the people who are at most severe risk of death, so the people who are, you know, 65 and older, vaccination rates in those people in the UK and the US are extremely high. And we're starting to see the benefit of that. So that's the little bit of good news that's sort of captured in the midst of all of this sort of craziness.
That's great. Now, I read an article about this, about how you talked about this, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, this idea of once the vaccine started rolling out, that are we going to see a decoupling between vaccination increases and hospitalizations? And now we're seeing that in a profound way, which is a huge benefit to see. My question to you is, in the past, I kind of took a sense of, maybe not a solace by any means, because I never want to see an increase of hospitalizations and death, but like, with vaccine positive cases, you know, early on people were getting tested like crazy. Now testing has kind of morphed into less of an intensive reality. And so then I was kind of like really putting all my bets on the reality that, well, even if people aren't going in to get tested, we can still look to hospitalizations to see roughly a proportion. Okay, well, clearly there's more spread going on because we're seeing an increase of hospitalizations. Because you can't hide that, right? You got to go to the hospital. But now we don't have that figure. We're seeing an increase. Are we thinking that maybe there's even way more than we think? Because I would imagine way less people than last year are even thinking about getting tested at this point in time.
Yeah.
So how do we factor that in at any level, or are we factoring that in?
Yeah.
The psychology of all that.
That's great. So absolutely. So testing rates overall are sort of declining. They've sort of plateaued to some extent. And so, yeah, we have always been undercounting COVID cases, and we're probably undercounting by even more now because fewer people are getting tested. And so you're right. So it can be difficult to compare the raw numbers of cases from now to the winter, because we're probably undercounting by an even greater degree than we were then, which is interesting. So I think, you know, one of the questions sort of implicit in that is that a problem? Should we be testing more? And it's sort of what's the purpose of testing at this stage in the pandemic? And I think this has been one of the most difficult things to sort of both communicate, but also to sort of wrap my own mind around, is what is the purpose of testing? Because actually getting a test for COVID usually serves multiple purposes, depending on where you get it. But even a single test will serve multiple purposes. So if I am going to travel, I might get a test before I go, just as sort of a baseline test. And so that's trying to sort of modulate my own behavior, where if it came back positive, then I would stay back. But that same test is also feeding into the data, where there's somebody who had a low prior probability of turning positive, but I'm contributing my negative test to that pool of tests. And so I woke up one morning with a sore throat and a headache. I might go to get tested because I'm symptomatic. And so then that also, you know, what I'm trying to do is to see if I should modulate my behavior, see if I should maybe think about going to the doctor to get these things checked out. And also, you know, this contributes to the overall surveillance of what's going on with COVID in the community. So now, you know, you layer in vaccination, where maybe if I'm vaccinated, I'm less likely to get tested, even if I'm symptomatic. So all of these probabilities are shifting underneath our feet. So what should we do with that? So I think one of the really difficult things about this period of time is that what COVID means, both individually and as a society, is starting to change. And to a large part, that's because of vaccination. So do we need to know exactly how much is spreading? I don't know. I definitely do want to know how many hospitalizations there are with respect to COVID. And I want to know what proportion of those people hospitalized with COVID are vaccinated versus unvaccinated, because that gives us a huge amount of information about if new variants are maybe starting to chip away at the protection that the vaccine provides. But what vaccination effectively does is it reduces the risk of severe outcomes from COVID vastly, to the point where it's basically in line with a lot of other risks that we face with other infectious diseases as we go about our lives. So then does it still make sense to follow up all of those cases? I don't know. I have some colleagues who say absolutely yes. You know, we need to be following up every single breakthrough case. We need to be testing as much as we possibly can. And then there are others, and I'm starting to shift a little bit more towards this side too, which is that, you know, testing requires a huge amount of resources. At least that level of testing takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of personnel. Are there other things that we could be doing that would be more effective at actually reducing the spread of COVID without actually following up every single one of these cases, especially in a world in which the risk of hospitalization and death given infection from COVID is not actually all that different if you're vaccinated from a lot of other risks that we face day to day that we don't track nearly as closely? Yeah. We're still in this murky middle ground where the answer is not clear, but I think we're sort of transitioning from one to the other, and figuring out how to do that gracefully, I think, is a really difficult problem.
Yeah. Well, two questions to follow up with that. The first one is, you talked about the idea of what would it be like if we reallocate these resources to something else to help prevent the spread? Do you have an idea of what good you'd replace with that, either in particular or in general? Like, oh yeah, an example would be, let's reallocate the resource from X to Z.
Yeah. So a couple of things. So one, rather than maybe widespread testing in the population, sort of concentrating surveillance testing on schools and on places where people interact very frequently. So instead of focusing on the whole population, focus on places where you expect there might be spread, where you really want to make sure that things don't get out of hand. Improving ventilation in schools. So hiring consultants to come out and help schools figure out how to improve their HVAC systems, how to improve sort of just education around the people who are maintaining the upkeep of these schools so that, again, aerosols don't build up in the air and we prevent infections in places where people gather. Same is true for restaurants and bars and things like that. So if we could really, emphasize that. And then also, one thing that I've sort of been hoping that we would do that I haven't really seen a lot of at all is helping to provide people with effective masks. So surgical masks or even respirators in places, for example, people who are like driving public transit, bus drivers, train drivers, they're a lot of the masks that they're wearing are still in some cases even homemade or, there's a lot better that we could do both for the general population, sending people a couple of masks and especially for people in high contact areas. So I think there's a lot of really practical things that we could do with the same resources that would really go a long way towards interrupting spread. But we can be a lot more targeted because I think we're doing enough surveillance to know when cases are ticking up in an alarming manner. And we don't necessarily need to see every case to know that here in Massachusetts, in most of the country, cases are going up. Do we need to know exactly by how many? I'm not sure. I think just the fact that they're going up is enough for us to sort of start to calibrate these things and to start to understand who needs these interventions. Where do we allocate these resources? Those are the sorts of things I'd like to see instead.
Yeah. And, another question with this is, and this would be, I think, a way more difficult one. I think this is what you're getting into. My guess is, if I get into your mind, maybe this is what you're thinking, is when do you normalize this? Like you were saying, we're at a point now where those who are vaccinated are dealing with a threat that's similar to other regular viruses that we do not have this kind of measure of containment and measurement and that kind of stuff. What is there a standard by which we can actually transition to say, okay, we've reached this moment by which we can now, I think we talked about this last week, and this is going to be, I think, the perennial difficulty of dealing with a pandemic is when do you move it from an outlier to something that's actually fabricated into the daily rhythm of life, just like we don't measure flu every positive case. That right. is this more of an art than a science for this? Or when we're culturally ready, or is there like a metric by which we can look at?
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of room for discussion on this, I think. And there's nothing that's really cut and dry. I think probably the best way to think about it is to place it in the contexts of other risks that we face every day. And so in this case, I think that flu is a reasonable thing to look at. Part of my hesitancy in looking at flu is that actually, I think we could do a lot better at preventing illness and death from flu too. As we start to compare risk from COVID to risk from other things, we also have to really critically examine should we be accepting this level of risk from these other things as well? But putting that to one side for now, there are risks that we accept every day, including the risk of getting in our car and driving down the street or of, flu every year. And so I think that, one of the ways that we can start to measure that is looking at a long enough time horizon, usually on the order of a year, and asking, how many people are dying? How many people are hospitalized from each of these things on average over the course of a year in a particular population? And then ask ourselves sort of, how does COVID stack up? Right now, deaths from COVID are still exceeding, the rate of deaths from COVID is still exceeding that from flu. But as vaccination increases, as ideally, we find better ways to manage it during surges, hopefully that will come much more in line. And then once it's sort of on par with those other risks that we've come to accept, we can then say, okay, well, now it's time to sort of fold this into this portfolio of other risks that we face every day, while also recognizing that we can make a lot of progress on these other risks too, to improve well-being. Mm. this is always really challenging because that risk will change depending on age groups, depending on the community you're living in, depending on all sorts of different things. And so there's a real danger of doing too much averaging, where if we, for example, average the number of deaths from COVID over the entire country, we might really be missing out on a huge number of excess morbidity, mortality that's occurring in certain age groups or certain communities. And we need to make sure we're not doing that. So we need to make sure we're doing these things sort of on the local scale whenever possible. But as long as we're doing that thoughtfully, then I think, comparing this to other risks that we accept in our day-to-day lives is sort of one good metric for determining when we're ready to transition into this being just a reality of our lives.
Great. And now you just said how even at this level, at this point in time, you know, being well over a year into the pandemic, we're still at a place by which the rates of death and are much larger than or significantly larger than flu and other things in our life as well. Given the increase in cases, the acceleration of the Delta variant, do you prescribe anything right now in generally different for the communities right now? So we're seeing medical professionals, I don't think the CDC has done it yet, but medical professionals advocating even now people wearing masks outside, even if you're vaccinated, because of the increase of variants. In discussion there at Harvard, is there anything going on at this point in time? Should we advance the level of our caution or still maintain the CDC policies of if you're vaccinated, you're good, unless you're in a big population?
Yeah. So I think it's tricky. So there may well be, and I anticipate there probably will be, a time when we're going to have to start wearing masks indoors again. Yeah. Certainly for unvaccinated people who I think by CDC guidelines should be wearing masks indoors anyway, but it might make sense for vaccinated people to start wearing them inside too. Full disclosure, I am generally wearing a mask indoors anytime I'm indoors anyway. Yeah. I just feel like it's a small thing that I can do that's an extra layer of protection for the people around me. And so in my mind, that's just a trade-off that makes an awful lot of sense. But especially as cases of Delta start to increase, those kinds of things will probably have to start bringing back to some extent. So I think it's still early days. We may not need that quite yet, but I think, you know, stay tuned. There's definitely some communities here in Massachusetts where cases are accelerating more quickly that have just as of today or yesterday reinstated an indoor mask mandate. And so I think it's coming. It may only be coming for particular communities at different times. It may not be a national sort of thing, but I think that also makes sense. I think the story of this epidemic over the next few months is probably going to be a very local sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense to treat it as such.
Great. Now you just mentioned how your personal preference right now, as you go inside, you wear a mask. It's a small contribution you can do to help keep COVID at bay. So let's take that and move that into what the CDC was talking about. And there's been some criticism about what do we measure when it comes to breakthrough cases? This is all the discussion the past week, 2 weeks has been, we're seeing, you know, maybe in June, it was 1% of cases are coming from the vaccinated people. Now we're seeing a much bigger number, and at least relatively speaking, that are coming breakthrough infections coming through, you know. So two things. Can you help us understand the difference between breakthrough infections and breakthrough disease? Because I'm sure you've talked about this many, many times, but I saw that distinction a couple of days ago. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. There's a difference between those two. And then CDC, if I'm getting this correctly, has decided, or at least maybe they've changed it. I don't know. At least there was one point in time they wanted to measure breakthrough disease and not necessarily breakthrough infections. But there are some people saying, no, we need to be measuring these because we don't know to what extent we're transmitting this to other people, those who had the vaccine. Maybe why that extra level of caution for you to wear the mask. And it's also helpful for genomic research to know to what extent is the vaccine causing variants. And so measuring this will be helpful for us. And I'm guessing you said you had an interview just recently talking about this, and you may have a little bit of a different flavor to a response to the criticism of the CDC.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of folds into some of what we were talking about before with testing in general, mm-hmm. which is that, you know, does it make sense for us to follow up every single breakthrough infection? And breakthrough infection is an especially difficult thing to do because by definition, if it's an infection but not a case, you're not showing symptoms. And so figuring out how to test those people well, you essentially have to do regular testing for everyone, always regardless of vaccination status, which may not be a bad idea, but should we be using those resources for that or for something else? So before I get too far, you asked about the distinction between breakthrough infection and breakthrough disease. So breakthrough infection is when someone who is vaccinated becomes infected with SARS-CoV-2, but remains asymptomatic. So you can become infected, which means usually in this case, meaning that you can test positive through a PCR test, but you don't go on to show disease. Now, one of the really important things about this is that oftentimes when a person who's vaccinated becomes infected, they do become infected. They are able to turn positive on PCR, but they frequently don't even produce enough virus to infect another person. Mm. And so especially in that case, it's like, okay, so the person is not showing symptoms. They're not even infectious to others. Is that something we really care about? Yeah. Yes, from a research perspective, I'm an epidemiologist. I want all of the data I can possibly sure. get. But from a practical perspective, for somebody who's in charge of running a national public health agency, I understand why following up every single one of these might not be the top priority. Breakthrough disease, on the other hand, is what it sounds like, where you're someone who's vaccinated, who's been infected, and then has progressed to show symptoms. Now, that's something that we might want to pay some more attention to. I think that there's still some latitude here for disagreement, because if a vaccinated person does go on to show symptoms, they're still unlikely to have severe outcomes from those symptoms. And so, again, this is sort of in this paradigm of trying to shift the risk from COVID into something like the risk of other infectious diseases that we deal with all the time. I still become symptomatic with flu, with other coronaviruses as well, but does it make sense for every single one of those cases to be tracked? I don't know. There may well be bigger fish to fry. Now, breakthrough hospitalizations, breakthrough infections that lead to death, absolutely. Yeah. You know, we should be following those up, because if we start to see that the risk of hospitalization or the risk of death starts to edge in vaccinated people closer towards what it is in unvaccinated people, right now the difference is still vast. Yeah. But if it starts to increase, then that's a real cause for alarm, right? Then we might really have a variant on our hands and something that we really have to pay close attention to. And I think that rightfully that's why the real emphasis is being placed on that. It's difficult because it means that you can't necessarily compare the numbers directly from unvaccinated people and vaccinated people, because we're treating them somewhat differently. And, you know, in some circles, that's a real cause for alarm and concern and allegations that, you know, we're trying to hide information or to make the vaccines seem better than they are or something like that. And I think that it's just really, as far as I can tell, this is sort of playing out in the context of really difficult practical realities with respect to testing. And so I think that, you know, we can always criticize what the CDC is doing, but a decision has to be made at some point. And I think that the decisions that they're making with respect to this are defensible.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we're at. So
that's helpful, because a couple things. Now, we probably talked about this already, at least in a roundabout way. In my mind, I'm thinking, I want to have it measured because of two things. Number one, to what extent are asymptomatic people spreading it and causing more spread? But you just mentioned, you've answered that. I saw an article that kind of repeated what you just said, that those who had the vaccine, even if they become asymptomatic, they have roughly 40% less viral load to actually spread. So this kind of goes into the question I wanted to ask as well, is the difference between vaccinated a positive case and an unvaccinated positive case. And there seems to be a dramatic difference. You've pretty much already said in the past 20 minutes that the viral load is significantly less for those who are vaccinated, if you are. Now, I can see another reason why I would want to be able to be tested. And that is, maybe I get it. I'm asymptomatic, but maybe I need to prepare for the possibility of me having long haulers, right? Something like that. But it's also another article I read. It seems like it's really, and maybe you can echo the same thing, I don't know if you've seen anything of it, it's really, 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 really unlikely that people are going to get a long haulers from a vaccinated positive case. Has that been a similar kind of discussion going on in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, it seems to be. So maybe, again, to add sort of some nuance to some of this, with how infections look between vaccinated and unvaccinated people, you know, you're absolutely right that on average, a vaccinated person is sort of at every step of the way less likely to progress. So they're less likely to get infected in the first place. If they're infected, they're less likely to show symptoms. If they show symptoms, they're less likely to produce as much virus as a person who's unvaccinated, and they're less likely to go to the hospital. So all of those things, they're sort of, the vaccine sort of puts a filter at each one of those stages, mm-hmm. and sort of helps screen you out from getting to each of them. That said, you know, one of the things in a lot of the conversation I've had with journalists and even just with concerned friends about this is that, you know, we're starting to see more breakthrough infections personally, yeah. right? Like I now know a friend of a friend who's been vaccinated and has shown symptoms from COVID. And there's something super alarming about this too, right? Like they got vaccinated. What the heck? You know, am I at risk? I've been vaccinated. I don't want to get COVID. You know, what should I do about this? And I think that, and this is where it's been really helpful to be looking at the data all along and the sort of thinking about the statistics about this is that, again, the vaccines are very effective. They're very helpful at preventing each of these progressions from one stage of illness to the next. But the way that I like to think about it is from the very beginning in the trials, the vaccines were 95% effective at preventing symptoms, right? Which is very good. Between 90 and 95% effective, basically. These are for the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, for example. What that means is that for every 20 unvaccinated people who show symptoms, you're going to expect one or two vaccinated people to show symptoms. Yeah. So the ratio is about 20 to 1, 20 to 2. That's actually not all that uncommon. Now, of course, if you show symptoms, you're less likely to go to the hospital. You're less likely, you know, all of these things. So the vaccines really especially protect against those severe outcomes. But I think it's worth bearing in mind that actually symptomatic breakthrough cases are not that surprising in some sense too. And so this is another reason why following all of them up doesn't necessarily make sense because it doesn't imply necessarily that there's a new variant or that there's something to be super alarmed about. It's just that as we've known all along, the vaccines are not a magic bullet. Mm-hmm. But they are helping us keep control of the epidemic. And so that's sort of one big sort of caveat in all of that. Now, we're still learning a lot about the long haulers issue. And I think that that's going to be one of the most interesting things is to see the relationship between vaccination and long hauling. There have been some anecdotal suggestions that even people who have suffered from COVID long hauling, their symptoms have improved after getting vaccinated as well. So like they developed COVID before they were vaccinated, they had long haulers, they got vaccinated, and the vaccine somehow seems to have contributed to some of those symptoms clearing up. Totally anecdotal. I don't think we have any solid evidence as to if that's actually the case on sort of a widespread scale. But I do think that the relationship between vaccination and long hauling is going to be super important. To my knowledge, we don't really know yet the extent to which vaccination prevents your odds of developing long haulers. I would anticipate that it is much lower in the sense that the vaccine seems to protect against every stage of illness. But one of the difficulties with this is both that long hauling is still not super well defined. And so it's difficult to say when exactly you have a case of it or not. And it also takes longer to develop. And so we're just going to need more time to collect those data too. So I would believe those kinds of things, but I think that we're still sort of in the early stages of getting evidence on the relationship between vaccination and long hauling.
That's good. Good. You know, speaking of which, I think what adds a level of complexity to breakthrough cases is you mentioned all the different, you know, 90%, 95%, but then they include, right, even those who've been given the first vaccine but didn't follow up and get the second vaccine. So this is going to skew statistics even more because we know that especially the variants are a little bit stronger against those who chose to get the first vaccine, but not the second one. And if they get a positive case, infection, or disease, they're still a vaccinated group, even though they weren't fully vaccinated, right? So they're part of that lump sum. Is that correct?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. So that's going to add some more of the statistics as well. So speaking of that double vaccination, I saw this in the news, just want to bring it out. It's interesting. Mixed AstraZeneca and Pfizer shot boost COVID antibodies up to like 6 times. So just showing now we've been talking about this for, you know, 6 months, 7 months about at some point in time, we're going to start seeing a lot more of these studies and tests of mixing two different types of vaccines to see how it increased the antibody levels. And I think that was a great first step with AstraZeneca and the Pfizer. Now, I did see that when it comes to the variants, particularly beta, gamma, and delta, it's not quite as a big of an antibody jump. But nonetheless, starting to see these tests show some good positive results. Okay, last thing I want to talk about before we go. I brought this up to you before we start recording, and I thought this was going to be a moot point, Stephen. And you're like, oh, this is actually kind of an interesting concept. So I wanted to bring up last week. We didn't have time for it. But I saw an article that U.S. life expectancy dropped by 1.5 years in 2020, right? So this is, I think, the most significant drop we have had in life expectancy since World War II. Now, I think it's not a big surprise. The reason for this is particularly COVID is the hallmark reason for why this happened. When I mentioned this to you, Stephen, you're like, oh yeah, this would be a really interesting topic because of X, Y, and Z, and explain you guys have been having some discussion about this. Why don't you chime in and talk about this life expectancy and what might be happening in the future and just the craziness and the complexities of dealing with this kind of the stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, there are so many different ways that we can look at the impact of this pandemic. You know, we've looked at excess mortality, we've looked at cases, we've looked at deaths and hospitalizations over time, cumulative, specific span of time, peak level. You know, there's all sorts of different ways that we can measure the impact of COVID. And one of them is this variation in life expectancy. One of the reasons people like to use this measure is because it's sort of a blanket measure of well-being across the population. Before we really dive into it, I want to, you know, sort of talk about what life expectancy is and what it is not. So what life expectancy sounds like is how long a person is expected to live if they were born on this day. And it's not really that. What it is actually sort of what a hypothetical, how long a hypothetical person would live if at every age they faced the same risk that a person who lived through this year faced. So that's why the COVID pandemic has had such a big impact on life expectancy. It's not to say that now everybody's, you know, we had a couple years shaved off our lives, although I do feel like I had a couple years shaved off my life after this past year. But what it's really saying is basically, you know, what sort of risk did we face over the course of this year? And because of all of the excess mortality from the pandemic, it decreased life expectancy. Now, one of the things that would have made this number go up even further is if COVID had been much more severe in younger people than in older people, for example. So that would have decreased life expectancy even more. So it's sort of a measure that sort of assesses risk of death over time by different age groups. And so on. So you're right. It is still really important that life expectancy for this year dropped by about a year and a half, which is more than it's dropped since World War II. And so there's that. So that's basically what it's measuring, is sort of this one more metric of sort of the impact of the pandemic over this past year. Now, what do we expect going into the future? Well, there's this really interesting phenomenon that's called mortality displacement. And the idea behind it is that, you know, everybody dies of something, but if in a particular span of time you're exposed to an excess risk, you are no longer going to die of what you would have died of. You die of that other thing instead. So in this case, that excess risk is COVID. Some people have talked about it using a word that I really don't like, but it's like basically like mortality harvesting in a way, where it's sort of like COVID has sort of collected people who would have died from other causes, but has made their cause of death COVID instead. And in some case, this is true, right? A lot of, especially people who were very old, who had lots of comorbidities, like those are the people who are most likely to die from COVID. And so they might have died in a couple of years from pneumonia or from some other kind of blood infection, but instead they died from COVID. So what does that do as we look forward to life expectancy? Well, this is actually a pretty well documented phenomenon in people who study demography and, you know, just sort of the study of populations over time, which is that when you have one of these, you know, really catastrophic events in a population, essentially, you see this mortality displacement phenomenon. And what it does is the people who basically had shorter times left for this world are the ones who are most likely to succumb to whatever it was. And that means that the remaining population actually, on average, has a longer span of life ahead of them. So what you see actually is this rebound. So there's this decline in life expectancy, but then in the following years, it kind of rebounds. And so there's this artificial increase in life expectancy for a couple of years following these catastrophic events until it sort of settles back into normal. Now, why is this interesting and not just sort of like an academic thing? You know, well, one of the ways that people frequently advocate for policy change is by quoting differences in life expectancy between racial and ethnic groups, between demographic groups, between geographic locations, for example. And we know that the pandemic has been more severe for certain groups, for especially disadvantaged groups, lower socioeconomic income, racial and ethnic minorities, these sorts of things. The rebound is usually proportional to the size of the decrease in life expectancy that we saw before. So we run the risk of in future years saying that, actually life has gotten a lot better for these disadvantaged communities. We thought that it was going to be really bad. We thought that, you know, they were going to be suffering for a really long period of time, but look, their life expectancy has actually increased, and it's increased by a factor even more than those communities that are better resourced. How good are we doing? You know, this is wonderful. We don't have to provide resources to these communities at nearly the rate that we thought we did, because it seems like they're just kind of taking care of themselves, which is not at all the conclusion we want to draw from this, right? Because really, yeah, it's just an entirely artificial rebound that sort of comes out of the way that these statistics are calculated. So that's something we're going to have to pay really close attention to in the coming years. And so as we're thinking about these life expectancy, I think I want to emphasize to not place too much doom and gloom on the decline in life expectancy. It's terrible, but it doesn't mean that you personally are less likely to live as long as you were before, yeah, assuming you're still listening to this podcast. But then also in the future, you know, we're going to see some really wonky things happening with life expectancy. And so it's worth sort of tempering our surprise at these things, because a lot of it just sort of falls out of the calculations.
I could definitely see this, right, in the future being used and hijacked for media and political influence. So it's good to kind of get that sobriety right here and right now. And also, I had no idea about what life expectancy really meant. And so thank you for clarifying that, because you think it's kind of just self-explanatory because it's life expectancy, but it's everything, like everything else, it's a little bit complicated, a little nuanced. Thanks for sharing that, Stephen. I think that'll end and wrap this episode up. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for all who are on live or watch it and split up in two different videos. Sorry for the little bug and technical difficulty. Same stuff. If you like a review, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Please support us, $5 a month. At patreon.com/pandemicpodcast or Venmo, PayPal, one-time gift, all in the show notes. Check out the show notes, because there's some really interesting articles that came out this week. I'll put them in there for you to read and enjoy. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next week. Take care and bye-bye.